Welcome to the AW360 Live Podcast, brought to you in association with Acast Marketplace, the home of podcast buying globally.
Acast Marketplace is the home of podcast buying globally. It's the world's biggest, most creative, fully brand-safe podcast exchange, connecting thousands of advertisers with millions of immersed listeners across every podcast player and platform there is. Global scale, quality content, innovative tools, and unrivaled creativity. Acast Marketplace for smart advertisers.
Welcome to the Advertising Week 360 Live Podcast, brought to you in association with Acast Marketplace, the home of podcast buying globally. It's a pleasure to be joined by Jason Xenopoulos, who is currently the CEO and Chief Creative Officer of VMLY&R. For those listening, I don't think that that's a particularly accurate description of your talents, because I think, you know, that they're a little bit more wide ranging than perhaps that single title lets on. So you've been a film director, you've been involved in sort of multiple entrepreneurial ventures. A good place to start would be by, you know, just telling us how did you get where you are?
Awesome, great, thank you. It's wonderful to be chatting to you today. You gave a pretty good overview. I started out as a screenwriter and film director. I studied at New York University at Tisch School of the Arts, where I studied film and television. And I went back to South Africa to hoping to make my first movie. Turned out it's harder to finance a film than I thought. Who knew? But in the process, it was the early 90s and the web was just becoming a thing. And I ended up starting a web development company, which was the right thing at the right time, grew really quickly. And within 18 months, we sold it to a big media company. And that sort of created the tension that has defined my career, which is sort of this tension between creating things like screenplays and films or kind of ad campaigns versus sort of creating and building companies, which was a sort of an accidental entrepreneur in many ways. But over the years, I've started started a number of agencies, creative companies. The most recent one was a company called Native, which was bought by WPP, became Native VML, and then became VML South Africa, and is now VML Y&R South Africa. And that's how I've found myself now in New York as the CEO of the New York office and CCO for North America.
Fantastic. I mean, that, amazing, you know, fascinating career path, but also that, that tension is really interesting to me. Many great film directors find themselves beginning their career as advertising creatives. So that connect, there is that inherent connection. However, the web development stuff is possibly slightly further afield than most, I think. I mean, what were you like as a child, like growing up? Were you very creative? Did you have your kind of Super 8 camera? Like, how did you explore that?
You know, I think my childhood was defined by just a very active imagination. So I spent a lot of time imagining things that I wanted to happen to me, that could happen to me. I started writing at a very, very early age. So I think for me, creativity has always, you know, been just a question of kind of conjuring stuff in my mind. But interestingly, I think that tension, you know, I've thought a lot about that tension and I've come to terms over the many years of my career now, realizing that it actually isn't a tension. It's actually a very vital symbiosis, this idea of creating work and creating companies, creating businesses. And I, to me, at the end of the day, strangely enough, it all comes down to storytelling. You know, people talk about, obviously, films are storytelling and advertising is storytelling, but actually being an entrepreneur is about storytelling as well. If you think about it, you are, you know, you're kind of hatching an idea and then you're finding a way to articulate that idea and bringing people together to help you execute that idea. And that's no different if you're making a film or if you're building a company.
Absolutely. Well, I think probably now that notion of storytelling rings more true than ever, given that so much has been done. You know, I think 20, 30 years ago, there was so much that hadn't been done. But now, you know, any great idea you have, it's probably been done. It's about how you can articulate that and execute properly.
Yeah, it's super frustrating. Every time I come up with what I think is a good idea, I do a quick Google search to see if someone else has done it, and it generally...
It has been there for 5 years.
10 times. Yeah. Exactly. But the real lesson is that just because something has been done isn't proof that you can't still do it better. And there have been things I've been... I remember in the late 90s, actually about probably 97, 98, someone saying to me, let's start a search engine. And I said to him, you must be crazy. Yahoo has totally tied up the space.
Oh my God. missed opportunities. I feel the same about not investing in Bitcoin in 2006 and 7, but here we are.
Exactly.
Okay, so you're going to be speaking at Advertising Week 2020, and session looks really interesting, and I was lucky enough to have a sneak preview of sort of some of your slides and what you're going to be looking at. So if I may quote your own presentation back to you, quite early on you mentioned a book by Douglas Rushkoff called Team Human, and he says that being human is a team sport. You know, from there, really, it seems like you've sort of expanded that idea out and taken that to the title, which is Renaissance Now. Can you talk us through why that book? I mean, clearly, that book has had an impact on you. What is it about it, and why?
Yeah, it's a great book, and actually, you know, Douglas Rushkoff is someone who I've read extensively and been very inspired by over the years. I guess in some ways we are probably contemporaries. Certainly, we began thinking about and working within the kind of online space at more or less the same time in the early 90s. He wrote a book called Siberia and then Media Virus. And those books were, I think he, like so many of us that were working at, you know, in the web at its sort of inception, had this really idealistic view of what the internet would bring, that it was this great kind of leveler, this egalitarian democratic platform that would, you know, would erode corporate power and would create a more even playing field for everybody. In fact, when we look back, what we see is that it has become, you know, the internet has become the greatest amplifier of wealth and power in history. And so in many ways, the ideals that we all were so excited about at the beginning have to some extent been subverted. And I think Team Human, like other things Douglas Rushkoff has written, is a recognition of that. But it's a recognition of the fact that unless we realize and regain an understanding of our interdependence as human beings, and in fact all living things on the planet, unless we regain a real respect for that interdependence, we are going to limit our progress and our ability to grow, because we are one, we are connected, and our success ultimately will only be achieved if we work together. And Team Human is really about that. It's about recognizing that although we've just emerged from perhaps the most individualistic century in history, we are a collective and we need to work as one in order to fulfill our potential.
That's a very interesting analysis. I think at the moment I'm reading Tribe by Sebastian Junger, which is just an amazing book, right? And I think speaks to a lot about that sort of disparate nature between Western civilized society and kind of the tribes, you know, that have been studied at an anthropological level. You look at Western societies, and as you say, there is that massive difference in terms of wealth and happiness, and I think a lot of that comes down to what we prioritize as a group, right? So here we, you know, material things are number one, whereas you look at tribes and it's kind of togetherness is a far more important commodity, punishable by, you know, death in some cases if you're a coward or a deserter or whatever. What is it about the internet that you think has caused that sort of that gap? I mean, you look at the difference in pay, you know, between CEOs, for example, right? Like I think 20 years ago, it was, you know, for every 20 for every dollar that a regular employee made, the CEO was making $20. You know, now in some of the S&P 500 companies, that's 1 to 300. You know, so you're just seeing this sort of enormous divide. Like, if you were to have a think about what some of the causes are of that,
I've thought a lot about it. For me, it comes down very simply to values. You know, the technology that we create is destined to amplify the values that that we inject into that technology. And so while the internet had the potential to be this egalitarian leveling of the playing fields, it was infused with the same kind of self-obsessed values of growth and greed and progress and materialism and so on, that came before the internet. And so as a result, that technology ended up amplifying those values. And the same is going to be true with whatever technologies we develop next, whether that be AI or anything else, which is why it is so vital for us to really align on a set of human values that we can lay into the foundation, not just of society, but of the technology that we create, because that is what our culture will become. And so for me, it all comes down to values. We have to set the right values. Mm. And if we have the right values, then the technology we create will amplify them rather than the wrong values that have governed so much of our progress to date.
Mm. No, I agree with that. And I guess to kind of skip ahead to a different part of your presentation, which is around a trend being technology and sort of AI's impact on future societies. I think that that's a very, very good segue to go into, right? I mean, you look at the Oxford Institute for Humanity, for example, that have been set up with the express purpose to ensure that the technology we're creating and the AIs that we're programming aren't going to go rogue or are being injected with the right values to ensure that as they develop and grow, that they are not doing malicious things, right? But I don't want to say, how important is AI, because I know how important it is, but I think within the context of kind of COVID and culturally what's happened, what place do you see it having?
Well, I think that, this conversation about the sort of values and ethics that underlie AI is something I'm going to talk about in the presentation, and is something that to me is really, really important, because a lot has been said about the dangers that AI brings with it. Its propensity to kind of amplify existing biases like gender bias or racial bias, or its ability to exacerbate income disparity because of the sort of joblessness that automation may bring. And while all of those dangers are super, super relevant, I do think that AI, because it is going to be this giant amplifier of values, is a wonderful opportunity for us to recode the values of society. Because if an algorithm that has, accidentally been built in a way that is likely to reinforce racial bias, is a possibility, then surely the opposite is true too. Surely if we can accidentally put racial bias into an algorithm, we can purposefully build an algorithm designed to, to dilute or remove or fight racial bias. And so I think that AI is without a doubt going to reinforce and amplify the values that its creators build into it. And we therefore have an opportunity now to think very long and hard about the values that we want to encode into society, because we have an opportunity to kind of hack the DNA of our culture. And that's certainly once in our lifetime opportunity, and maybe once in a generation opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, look, I completely agree. I mean, you've seen, I don't know if you remember what happened with Microsoft Tay, for example, 4 or 5 years ago, when you had that sort of that bot that went completely rogue and was spouting all kinds of racist nonsense over Twitter over a sort of 24-hour tirade. And it just shows you, stuff can go very wrong. Do you believe really that it's possible to create benevolent AI?
I mean, I think it's possible to create benevolent AI and benevolent technology. I do think, though, that, you know, our past track record does demonstrate the opposite. I mean, if I look at social media and the unintended consequences, I'll be nice, the unintended consequences mm-hmm. that have arisen from a lot of the sticky tools that we've built into social media, you know, our track record is such that the things that we create in pursuit of progress, the things that we create in pursuit of profit, these things are dividing us. These things are putting us into silos and echo chambers and exacerbating the division in the world rather than our connectedness. So yes, our track record doesn't suggest that you can, but logic tells me you absolutely can. We just have to have that intention, and we have to be unrelenting in our determination to, you know, to manage an outcome, a consequence of these technologies that is in you know, for the benefit of society and humanity as a whole, rather than the few elite, you know, kind of people at the top.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so I want to take us back to February, March this year. So coronavirus is a terrifying prospect. It's all over the news. It's a sort of unknown disease. Everyone's feeling pretty terrified and the world is starting to shut down. But what were the things that stuck out to you right at the beginning about, you know, the sort of wider cultural impact of what this would bring?
You know, I think we've all just had a sort of roll with the punches. I mean, no, obviously no one was in any way prepared. There was a lot of confusion at the outset about how brands should behave and what brands should do or shouldn't do or should say or shouldn't say. You know, I think that the brands who have misstepped are those who have not acted in an authentic, honest way. And as much as this was, you know, everyone uses the term all the time, unprecedented, these unprecedented times, who knew what to do? The truth is, you know, if you were honest, if you were authentic, and if you behaved in an open, honest, and authentic way, which is, you know, there's nothing unprecedented about that. It's the, you know, it's the oldest truth in the book. I think those are the brands that benefited. For me, though, I think that the amazing thing about COVID is that for all the pain and suffering it has caused, and you know, one cannot underestimate how much pain and suffering it has caused, it has also yielded some really, really critical lessons. And for me, chief among those is, I think a growing level of empathy between people who have been forced to recognize that we are all connected, that we are interdependent. This is the most democratic and egalitarian enemy we've ever had. It affects everyone equally, from, you know, presidents. We've seen presidents and prime ministers with COVID virus through to, you know, poor people as well. So I think that for me is kind of the biggest lesson. And most of the trends that I think are going to bubble to the surface are those that are connected to this sense of interconnectedness that comes from, you know, from a global pandemic.
That perspective has been very interesting. I mean, you know, we were talking before we got on. It sounds like you're not sort of in and amongst. Well, you're not in Manhattan, right? So life for you was probably nowhere near as sort of busy as, you know, living in London, which is where I am, or being in the heart of Manhattan. For me, at least, that sense of perspective I got when everything was just suddenly slowed down was very impactful on me, and I suspect everyone, you know, many people went through the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I live in Westchester, but I, up until March 13th, worked, in Manhattan at 3 Columbus Circle, just off the park. And, you know, every day I sort of did my commute into the city and walked from Grand Central up to the park. And, you know, it was super busy and packed lifestyle and schedule. And, you know, suddenly I was back home and, you know, working from my leafy garden in Westchester, which, you know, has not been all bad. You know, I'm very, very fortunate and for the first time realized just how fortunate I was not to be cooped up in a small apartment. I have three teenagers, I have teenage triplets. So, you know, being cooped up in an apartment with three teenagers would have driven me, you know, completely crazy. But having some space and, you know, has been a godsend. But absolutely, perspective, man, perspective like we would never have thought possible. And I think that is going to have a long-term impact on how culture evolves.
Completely. I think particularly from the working perspective, you know, and this is something that you're going to be talking about really is it, the world of work has changed forever, you know, and it's like, I think it's possibly for the best, you know, in the sense that consider the number of opportunities that have suddenly become available for, I don't know, someone working in London who is maybe looking to work, you know, previously the idea of working for a company based in San Francisco or anywhere else, if you were a Londoner or if you lived in Amsterdam, was an impossibility. But now not only is it, it's possible, but there are enormous opportunities out there. And you know, you look 6-7 months ago, the idea of, you know, if you would chat amongst friends and say, oh, I work remotely 2 days a week. Everyone would that comment itself would be met with, oh wow, you know, that's fantastic that your company lets you do that. I think now we have the exact opposite in the sense that if your company is forcing you to go into the office, they're seen as evil at this point. So, what's your view as to kind of where we go next? I mean, I'm assuming some of it is going to stick, but how much do you think of it will?
Well, I mean, I don't think you can put the genie back in the box. I do think that. You know, people have now gotten a real sense of how effective, efficient, and valuable remote working can be. I don't think we're going to return to, you know, the 5-6 days a week in the office that we used to have, you know, in general. So I do think that, you know, companies have discovered how much money is to be saved out of a reduced real estate footprint. I think people have discovered the benefits of having the flexibility to work from home at certain times. I think what we're going to see though is a marriage between these two things. I think it's a false dilemma to compare and question the relative benefits of working from home versus working from the office, because I think there are strengths and weaknesses to both. And I think what we're going to see is a hybrid. I think that the things that you can do remotely, like returning emails, answering phone calls, writing reports, these things should be done from wherever it's convenient for you to do them. And the office should be reserved for collaboration, for human interaction, for play, for, you know, creative pursuits where people need to be together. So I'm hoping we're going to start seeing an on-site remote working hybrid that allows us to use our home offices for what they are best designed for, and our office offices for what, you know, for the value of human interaction and play that they can instill.
Yeah, for sure. And I think kind of to further that point, you're going to have many, many companies who are looking at their office space and going, we've just taken out a 6-year lease on a five-story building in the middle of Manhattan that's costing us a fortune. We now need to cut back. And of course, with that, make workplaces safe for employees to return to. And of course, with that in mind, you're going to have, you're going to have entirely new fields of architecture that are going to come out in terms of designing COVID safe workspaces, which is just like, as a slight nerd, is somewhat fascinating, I think. How are you thinking about that, and how is your agency thinking about that? And you mentioned sort of human-centered design being a very important aspect. I feel like those fields, whilst we're coming closer together, have no choice but to continue on that collision course.
Totally. And, you know, I'll talk about a lot of the stuff in the presentation about, you know, the impact that this is going to have on architecture and urban design. Certainly the sort of empathy, you know, the empathic human-centered design approach to things. But I think, you know, for me, it's we are starting to really think long and hard about how we can reinvent the office environment to better serve, you know, the our culture. And our culture is really built around a connection. It's built around collaboration, creativity, and being connected. And I think we have an opportunity now to ensure that our physical spaces are reshaped to make the most of that. So I think, you know, culture, I believe that in any business today, culture is more important than structure. It's more important than strategy. It's the most important differentiator that any company has. And your physical environment has a massive influence on culture. And we suddenly have an opportunity to rethink that, to reimagine that, to reshape it, and to not allow our culture to simply emerge from what the physical office is, but rather to allow to reshape that physical space in order to help it more purposefully cultivate the kind of culture that, you know, that we want.
I think that's fantastic. Okay, well, my final question to you before I will release you is as a CEO of an agency and an organization with, you know, people on your payroll and staff and whatever, you know, what's top of your agenda in terms of culture as people are beginning to return to the office or not? Maybe we don't know exactly what's going to happen, but what's going on in your brain right now as it relates to that?
Well, I think it is all about connectivity between people. You know, I mean, for a company who sees culture as its biggest differentiator, obviously, you know, culture is nothing but the sort of, you know, the emergent dynamic between people. So it's all about the people. And while I think we've been incredibly efficient working remotely, and you and I are having a great conversation, you know, on Zoom right now, there is an interpersonal dynamic that is being slowly but surely eroded by not having a physical connection. And so I think we, I am very concerned about ensuring that we have created enough forums for connection, that people stay connected, and you know, people that have known each other and worked together for a long time, it's easier. But as new people are onboarded and new people come into the organization within these circumstances, it's much more difficult for them to become onboarded, to become connected. We work very, very hard at creating the kind of cultural context necessary for people to feel connected and to feel supported. And we'll continue to do that, because that is the most important part of certainly my job.
Absolutely. Okay, cool. Well, look, thank you so much for doing this. For anyone listening, Jason's session will be available on Advertising Week 2020's site throughout the entirety of October, should you want to listen to this or watch it, which I hope you will, having heard this discussion. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Get your brand into the ears of millions of immersed podcast listeners with Acast Marketplace. Podcast sponsorship, ads, and branded content reach niche and mainstream audiences in the most intimate environment. Global scale, quality content, innovative tools, and unrivaled creativity. Acast Marketplace, for smart advertisers.